Kreisky-Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
Damen und Herren, liebe Freundinnen und Freunde des Bruno-Kreisky-Forums, ich begrüße Sie wieder mal bei einer Veranstaltung im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum im Rahmen unserer Veranstaltungsreihe Genial dagegen. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass wir wieder mal die Möglichkeit haben, Gwyn Slobodien hier bei uns zu begrüßen. Gwyn, wunderbar, dass du da bist.
Danke.
Wieder einmal sage ich deswegen, weil schon im Jahr 2019 war Gwyn Slobodien bei uns mit seinem Buch Globalists, auch im Suhrkamp Verlag erschienen. Er ist Historiker, Ökonom, Wirtschaftshistoriker, Ideengeschichtler, könnte man auch sagen. Und da ging es um die Ideengeschichte des Neoliberalismus. Und in dem neuen Buch, das er heute präsentiert, geht es darum natürlich auch, wenn gleich auch in einer sehr spezielleren Form. Er führt uns gewissermaßen in unbekannte Territorien durchaus im doppelten Sinne, nämlich einerseits örtlich, die sind natürlich nicht unbekannt, aber in ihrer Dichte vielleicht doch, aber gleichzeitig, ja sagen wir mal, in die Welt der verrücktesten Ideen neoliberaler oder libertärer, radikaler, man könnte auch sagen, in die Welt der Madman des Neoliberalismus. Und auch das ist ja durchaus für vernünftige Menschen, sage ich jetzt mal, gelegentlich ein unbekanntes Territorium. Das Buch heißt, damit ich es nicht vergesse, Kapitalismus ohne Demokratie, wie Marktradikale die Welt in Mikronationen, Privatstädte und Steueroasen zerlegen wollen. Ganz frisch im Suhrkamp Verlag erschienen. Gwyn hat eine Lesereise fast hinter sich, die ihn durch ganz den gesamten deutschsprachigen Raum geführt hat. Und wir freuen uns, ich sage das nochmal besonders, dass er heute auch in Wien ist. Er wird mit einer Präsentation beginnen und dann haben wir ein Gespräch am Podium. Ja, Gwyn, the floor is yours. Danke dir.
Yeah, thanks everybody for coming. I thought I'd just begin with some visuals because it is a very visual story I'm telling, or actually a bit more of a cartographic story. There's a lot of maps. Each of these chapters begins with a map. And I think partially because, as Robert just said, a lot of the ideas in the book are quite strange, it helps to have something to sort of ground the ideas in, to have the realization this is not just the sort of thought worlds or the castles in the air that certain radical libertarians are building, but in many cases there's a reference point, you know, here on planet Earth. So in my short presentation at the beginning today, I want to sort of make the case to you all that we not only would be helped by understanding something called the zone, but that it's very hard to understand actually a lot of the more radical developments inside of global capitalism and in ways inside of party politics and governments without understanding this political geographic category of the zone. So what I think that the book does, I'm afraid you can't read that very well, but it says that this book sort of challenges what I think are three theses or kind of assumptions about post-Cold War order. What are those theses? One of them is the supranational thesis. And this, you can call this a thesis, you could also just call it a kind of a plot line or a narrative, that since the end of the Cold War, I think there's been an assumption that we are moving as a human race towards more integration. There's a movement from sort of nation states upwards into integrated blocks like the European Union, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA. So the direction of travel for political developments is upward. There's also the well-known end of history thesis, you know, connected with Francis Fukuyama, the idea that there's sort of one form of politics that will define the present and the future, and that is the politics of liberal democracy and liberal democratic capitalism. Thirdly, and this one somewhat more implicitly, the idea that the final point of organization for humans will be into more or less things that we can call nation states. So although you are nested within something like a European Union or something like a trade federation, still the transition of the 20th century is from a world of empires to a world of nations, and there is not going to be a kind of a form beyond that. The nation is kind of the natural container for human life and for human society, so we can expect to stick with it for a while. So in this short time I have today, I'm going to hope to challenge each three of these theses sort of in turn. But I want to begin doing so by drawing attention to some of the categories that I used in my last book. So in my last book, I introduced this idea by way of the work of neoliberal intellectuals, that we can understand global order best, not in terms of kind of global north and south, or east and west, or three worlds, but understood as two kind of overlapping spheres, the spheres of dominium and imperium. Dominium, captured often in images like this, this one came from the IMF, but you're familiar with them, suggests kind of a world of goods, a world of property that is sort of theoretically global, an idea of a trade system that links the entire sphere of the planet Earth and in some way sort of transcends national differences. The other category is imperium, which is the category of sovereignty, the government of people rather than things, and the government of democracies and nations. The story that I told in Globalists, and the story that I still think is very relevant, is about the sort of tension between these two ways of organizing the world. On the one hand, a world in which property is sacred and sacrosanct, and if you own something in one part of the world, you can claim it equally well on the other side of the world. And on the other hand, the idea of national sovereignty, which often pushes against the idea of kind of globally protected property rights. So I still think that this is a helpful way to think about the world, but I think that there's a problem or kind of a trap in this framing, in this kind of binary framing. And that is, I think, that we can end up thinking about the world economically as kind of having only two settings. Either there's a setting that says globalization, or there's a setting that says nationalism. And since 2016 in particular, since Brexit, since Trump, since the rise of the AfD, the FPÖ, many other right-wing parties, we've had a kind of narrative which dominated the commentary, which is that we had been in a world since the end of the Cold War of globalization, and now we've moved back to a world of nationalism, right? We can remember all of these metaphors. The walls are going up, the bridges are being raised, the barricades are being drawn, we're having a backlash, deglobalization, the pendulum in the Polanyian sort of metaphor has swung from one to the other. The other metaphor that we often hear was that the world in which nations stuck to certain international trade laws was a world where governments willingly tied their hands, so said, we won't interfere, we'll respect the rights of property, we'll respect the rights of free trade. But in 2016 and since then, Ulysses has sort of broken away from the mast, and the ship of order is sort of veering, you know, threatening to smash against the rocks. The danger that was often expressed is we're returning to the world of the 1930s, right? So I think this is the mainstream narrative that we've been hearing for the last 7 years or so, is that we had globalization, now we've gone back to nationalism, and that's bad. How can we get back to globalization? But as probably many of the people in this room would agree, globalization had its problems too. Right, I think there's people from Attack Austria, but I think in the room here, or there has been last time I spoke. And I wouldn't think that our goal politically, or even in terms of understanding, would be try to figure out how to get from this imaginary space of nation back to the space of globalization. For me, as a historian, I think that this is a problem of description, not just a problem of politics. I think we've actually described this backlash poorly. If we think that it is about just going back to the 30s, or back to the nation, or withdrawing from globalization. As commentary after commentary pointed out, globalization actually is increasing. There's more cross-border trade. 2016 didn't end globalization. It's just changed the nature of it. But we lack the vocabulary to talk about how it's changed. One of the ways that I'm going to introduce the idea of this short talk, the zone, is by thinking about it in terms of the what I call the three moments of secession in the 20th century. These are graphs of new sovereign states. At the end of the First World War, you get a bunch of new sovereign states as the Habsburg Empire collapses, the Russian Empire ends, the Ottoman Empire ends. In the 1960s, overseas European empires, the so-called saltwater empires in Africa and Asia, come to an end, and the wave of what is often called decolonization happens. In the 1990s, the end of state socialism and the dissolution of the Soviet Union produces another kind of crop of new states, as well as the dissolution of Yugoslavia. So in the narrative I told in Globalists and in the narrative I'm telling in my new book, these are really important moments when order is sort of threatened and then reasserted for some kind of new settlement. The way I told it in Globalists is that these were two moments when nationalism sort of spiked. People started to put more faith in imperium and to question dominium. And there was a kind of reassertion of principles of property, principles of free trade, through things like the advance of the World Trade Organization, international investment law, and so on. The more I thought about this, though, trying to historicize the challenge of 2016, is I realized that this 90s moment was actually different than the years before it, the secessions before it. One of the reasons it was different is that we no longer actually had only one option for the way that governments transformed after decolonization. The nation was actually no longer the kind of telos or the endpoint of political transformation. In fact, by the 90s, the nation had been joined by this new political geographic category of the zone, which was in many cases sort of creating holes and punctures and perforations inside of existing nation states. The zone, which is a place that is within a nation but given a different legal status, separated self-consciously away from the government of the host country, lower taxes, lower regulations, often more rights of foreign ownership, is directed to bring in investment from abroad, and is a fundamentally different thing than a nation. Nations, for all of their incompletion, have a kind of legacy that goes back to these iconic moments, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, 1848, moments of popular sovereignty, where at least the idea is that the citizens of a particular part of the world express their desires, and it is given form in something called the nation. The zone works the exact opposite. The zone is designed for others. It's not designed for people inside of the place that it designates. So this immediately for me started to suggest that there's actually a kind of a third category we should bear in mind if we want to understand not just political economic developments, but also kind of the aspirations of countries. So it's not just kind of world and nation, it's world nation, and this here is a map of the world's special economic zones. Now this is a very different geography, actually, than either an idea of just the free movement of goods throughout the world in these sort of laser beams, or the division of the world into the checkerboard of national maps. So in the last couple of minutes that I have here, I'm going to suggest that, as in the classic John Carpenter film, They Live, when Rowdy Roddy Piper puts on the sunglasses and he can suddenly see the messages that had been hidden from him, I think that if we put on our zone glasses, we begin to actually see much differently, and also and specifically this idea of a right-wing backlash, a backsliding, a sort of a return to the 1930s becomes something that we would no longer entertain. Let me give you a quick series of examples to make my point, and then we'll begin our conversation. One of them is the very important example of China. So there are about 6,000 of these zones in the world right now. The most important ones, and about half of them, are in the People's Republic of China. It was the way that China liberalized and opened up its internal market, zone by zone. Deng Xiaoping called it crossing a river by feeling for stones. But as I sort of quip in the book, it was also crossing the river by feeling for zones. The opening up of China piece by piece, the re-commodification of land and labor, reintroduction of wages, reintroduction of private property happened here first as a direct emulation of Hong Kong. And by now, the Belt and Road should make us see that what we actually see is a globalization of zoning strategies by China, and all the places that it sets down are inside of nations, but also not of those nations. They have a different legal status. They're usually owned and operated by Chinese-owned companies, often on 99-year leases, exactly as Hong Kong's new territories have been on a 99-year lease. So China's growth and expansion understood only, I think, with the category of the zone. The so-called right-wing backlash in Britain, led by the British Conservative Party, is very much caught up in this zone fever as well. Rishi Sunak, for about 10 years, his only real idea has been opening up what he calls free ports or enterprise zones along the coast of the United Kingdom as a way to try to emulate what other countries have done, poorer countries, places like China, Singapore, and Dubai. Make it more attractive for foreign investors, lift regulations, lift labor laws, lower taxes. In this sense, to think about Brexit or the Conservative Party as having been turning them back on the world market or turning to Little England, I think is totally off base. It's been a practice of trying to hyper-globalize, often unsuccessfully, but by intention, and often through a kind of embrace of the logic of the zone. Another example is in Hungary. Often Orban would also be seen as the sort of prototypical nationalist, turning away from integration, turning away from connection to other countries. He's deeply embraced zoning strategies, created a special economic zone, especially for Samsung, to keep the South Korean investor in the market. Poland is one of my favorites. Since 2020, the entire nation of Poland is a special economic zone. So the entire nation is eligible for all kinds of carve-outs, things that actually run directly against European competition law because they give special benefits to foreign investors. Another place that introduced special economic zones more recently that isn't a former socialist country is Italy, under Matteo Salvini's Lega-led government. Giorgio Meloni, another right-winger about who we will often read as just a nationalist or ethno-chauvinist, okay, but she's also right in line with radical capitalist zoning technologies. The plan now is to merge the entire south of Italy, the entire Mezzogiorno, into a single special economic zone. I have the quote from there that I'll read just a bit of. As she said, "We are convinced that the goal must be achieved by abandoning the logic of welfareism, which does not work, in providing opportunities for work and growth, and making these areas of the country competitive and attractive for investments and businesses." Totally normal neoliberal rhetoric, actually. Nothing particularly nationalist or 1930s about the language that she's using there. Another telling example is Putin, another person who has embraced zones. One of the biggest special economic zones in the world is the entire Russian Arctic free trade zone area, which is opened up with special concessions for foreign investment. Along the border with Iran, special economic zones are very important now for drone production, and also as ways to sort of get around the sanctions regime that is otherwise excluding Russia from the world market. Ironically there, the person who's building the walls is the United States, actually, through sanctioning against Russia. Russia is trying to get as much plugged into global markets as it can through the zoning strategy. Another important example in my book is Dubai, which perhaps more than any other place on earth, I can't say country because it's not a country, has completely carved up its entire small territory into custom-made, bespoke legal jurisdictions according to what people want. You want media city, you get these laws. You want education city, you get those laws. You want pharmaceutical city, you get that. International Financial Center, you get that. Totally, designed, tailor-made for foreign investors. And like China has now globalized, what you see there with those yellow dots is all the places where DP World, which is the Dubai-owned state logistics company, owns and operates port infrastructure from, Vancouver all the way to Southeast Asia. In many cases, another theme of the book, landing in the same footsteps that the British Empire did before, but now the former colonized countries have sort of adopted the role that the British Empire once had in the 19th century. A couple more examples here just to sort of bring this home. Jebel Ali is the place, the foreign trade zone in the foreign economic processing zone in Dubai that's incredibly important and very iconic. India hasn't been that aggressive globally in the kind of special economic zone construction space until recently. But Adani, one of the biggest companies in India, is technically called Adani Ports and Special Economic Zones. And this is just from September 23, so a couple of months ago. They've announced a India, Middle East, Europe economic corridor, which runs from Piraeus, which as some people might know is owned by a Chinese and operated by a Chinese company, all the way to Mumbai through Jebel Ali. And this is, I think, important geopolitically through Haifa. So Adani now owns and operates the port in Haifa, which for some people curious about why Modi's government has turned 180 degrees on their position on Palestine as they have in the last couple of years. This might help to explain, you know, when we put on the zone glasses, we can kind of see how the extension of sovereignty outward through these nodal points also helps change the interests of states. One of my last examples here is one of my favorites, which is the city of Neom that Mohammed bin Salman is building in western Saudi Arabia. It is, for those of you who haven't heard about it, a 250 kilometer long straight city that includes huge sort of ammonia factories, green hydrogen, desalination plants, huge solar arrays, a huge floating harbor, port infrastructure. And notably, MBS promoted this by saying here that it would be the first capitalist city in the world. This is the unique thing that will be revolutionary. Without a doubt, at the end of the day, Neom will be floated in the markets. The first zone floated in the public markets. It's as if you float the city of New York. So this is the kind of far edge of the privatization of sovereignty, the commodification of sovereignty in these nodal spaces of special economic zones or private cities. So where does that leave us, just to sum up? What I would like to argue is that instead of the supranational thesis, the idea that everything was moving up and getting larger and more integrated after the end of the Cold War, we should think about kind of functional fragmentation. So nations were also dividing themselves up into new kinds of legal entities and legal jurisdictions, even as they were scaling up and joining larger treaties. Obviously, the idea of liberal democracy as the end of history is no longer persuasive. In fact, non-democratic capitalism is becoming ever more successful, an object of emulation by democratic countries too, from Orban to Sunak and beyond. And then lastly, the idea that the nation state is the only kind of natural place where humankind will eventually end up, I think should be challenged by these kind of perforations of the zone. So whether or not this future means one in which, you know, the globe is only zones, I'm sure is sort of maybe something that Robert and I will discuss in a minute. But anyway, I think to even begin to make sense of the curiosity of this moment where countries are both claiming to be breaking with the consensus while also accelerating harder into forms of capitalist competition, we need to understand that it's happening through these subnational political geographies that are making it all possible and attractive. Okay, I think I'll leave it at that and look forward to the discussion.
thank you, Gwyn, for this wonderful presentation for the beginning. Most of the presentation showed how the idea of nation state was performed, perforated by zones and new form of legal entities in the world. The book is very full of examples of that. And what we also know now is already what we have a feeling about is that also the another thesis of the post-war Cold War era that capitalism and democracy are married in a way. We see now already that this might not be such a stable marriage, and that there are also political forces who are decided against that. And maybe I want to start our talk about that. Your book also starts with Peter Thiel. He is not an unknown and a stranger in this country, especially also because a former chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, was hired by him as a global strategist back, I think, after he left his office, I think, two years ago. And Peter Thiel already in 2009 said, "I no longer believe that freedom and democracy are compatible. Politics is interfering in other people's lives without their consent." And in fact, Peter Thiel is ideology is an elitist, racist, and an anti-democratic ideology. I think his biographer said his ideas are bordering to fascism, and we should be scared. let's talk about: do we have to be scared about the radical conservative and authoritarian and anti-democratic ideas of this new ideological stream?
Sure. I mean, I think it's worth beginning by kind of historicizing that moment you just shared. This moment when, sort of famously, in 2009, Peter Thiel said, "I no longer think that democracy and capitalism are compatible." This is often a quote that's sort of used out, including by me, pulled out to kind of, you know, bludgeon Thiel as a kind of dubious political character. And I think it's used correctly that way. But as a historian, I'm always interested in saying, you know, what were the conditions under which someone could think something like that? You know, what made that thought occur to Peter Thiel, right? It wasn't his unique evilness. Mm-hmm. I don't think. It wasn't his kind of, he wasn't possessed by some, you know, extra supernatural kind of force. I think that, and this is a sort of a subplot in the book, is that we need to remember that the 1990s, the end of the Cold War, was a moment when U.S. foreign policy sort of had to reinvent itself, right? It no longer had the same enemy. It didn't have the Soviet Union and communism as its primary geopolitical rival anymore. And so it started to come up with new enemies, right? In some cases based on real things, but also it got creative, right? I mean, terrorism became something that it decided that it was now very concerned about. Genocide in places like Somalia now became something that it was really going to get involved in trying to reverse. And it was doing it all in the name of democracy, right? So people who loved democracy were the neoconservatives who were running US foreign policy in the 1990s and the early 2000s. And by the time Thiel says that in 2009, we are 6 years into a disastrous effort to bring democracy to Iraq at the barrel of a Tomahawk missile and a Bradley fighting vehicle. And there's sort of reason to doubt, right, the elite fixation on democracy at that point. And what I think, you know, Thiel speaking from the San Francisco Bay Area is speaking from an alternative milieu, which is the world of tech and the world of sort of practical solutions through software, through new gadgets. And I think that if we need to think about the early 2000s as a kind of a battle between, as one character, Balaji Srinivasan, called it, the kind of the old paper belt, as he called it, which was, you know, Washington with its laws, Boston with its degrees, New York with its newspapers, and then the new world of Silicon Valley, which was going to disrupt all of that, right? This was the ideology of the time. So in that sense, what Thiel was saying is like, democracy isn't working, and we need to start smaller. We need to experiment the same way that we've been experimenting in garages, quote unquote, in Silicon Valley for 20 years. And that would be a new way to kind of find a more appropriate form of politics for the future. Paul Romer, who went on to win a Nobel Prize, was saying the same thing at the exact same time, that democracy is overrated, basically. Hong Kong is the best performing economy globally and has been for decades. So let's start little experiments. Let's not get too moralistic about democracy, because that's only producing negative outcomes. And let's see what happens. And that's this world of kind of micro-ordering experiments is what I describe in the book as these sort of small efforts at zoning from here to there. Whether that's a worry or not, or whether it's a threat, I think needs to be interpreted in one of two ways. Either you say, yes, it is, because then all of the wealthy are going to secede with their wealth, whether it's already the way they do through tax avoidance, or if they're physically going to leave places, as they are in fact doing. California has lost a large part of its tax base by wealthy tech billionaires moving to Miami over the last few years. So that's one fear. They're just going to drain the revenue of what exists of a redistributive state in the United States. But the other fear that's almost worse is that they're going to decide that the whole nation is going to be their zone, right? Because Peter Thiel in 2009 was saying, the more nations we have, the better. My imagination is we're going to have hundreds and hundreds or even thousands of nations. When he started getting big contracts with the US government, he stopped worrying about creating new nations because he had a very good one right there, right? So his sort of idealism vanished, and I am more worried about the Peter Thiel who uses his Palantir technology to assist existing states than I am about the Peter Thiel who decides to go start a small micro state in the South Pacific that will inevitably fail. So I think that that's the kind of boomerang story that I'm most concerned about, and that in the end, the stakes are the highest at in this book. It's not really about just strange experiments. If it was only that, then it's amusing and like more power to them almost. Like, good luck.
Although it's very convincing, but my argument against would be that it's not that we cannot tell the story in the way alone that in the 2000s or the end of 2000s, this phase of neoconservative, pathos of democracy came to an end, and then a new story because the story was prepared already before. Also, the mainstream neoliberals were not really friends of democracy. Although at that time it would have been more common sense to say that democracy is the best system, the efficiency system, also the best efficient system to bring forward good ideas because of the intelligence of the crowd and all of that stuff. But also in the 70s and 80s, we had Milton Friedman who said that a free society needs a free economy, but democracy threatens a free economy because the masses then have a voice and they can say, okay, we want social programs and all of that. Yeah. So they were anti-democratic at that time already, and also Friedrich August Hayek was not a Democrat. What he imagined of democracy was not the democracy we usually would have seen as democracy. So what changed maybe was that this idea was not common sense, or was not even common sense, but not it doesn't have a relevance. But at the end of the 90s, it started to become a relevance because the argument democracy is so inefficient and authoritarian, capitalism would be more efficient. It became more convincing, obviously, in these circles.
Yeah, there was a moment of possibility for the breakthrough. I mean, there's a reason why I start the book with Hong Kong, Milton Friedman standing in Hong Kong in 1978. And I think you can draw out a lot from that moment. So why is Hong Kong so exciting to Milton Friedman in 1978? 1978 is at the end of a decade of strikes, inflation, oil crisis. What he saw as the exercise of democratic demands that were going to ultimately cripple capitalism and, you know, handicap it permanently. Decolonization was leading to a wave of new countries that were in many cases socialist, thinking about Julius Nyerere's Tanzania, speaking about African socialism, the new international economic order at the UN. The principle of democracy was actually kind of on the march in the 1970s. And to Friedman, that was producing economic catastrophe. So Hong Kong becomes a fascinating place where you look and you're like, this place is very strange. It's tiny. It's an anachronism. It's a leftover from British Empire. It should be extinguished soon. But in the minds of Friedman and others, it became a kind of Rosetta Stone for like a a sort of something they could use to translate their way out of the conundrum that they were in with the rise and march of mass democracy. But what they drew out of it were sort of different lessons, and this is a way of answering your question. One way that you can deal with democracy is to use what I described there as kind of the Ulysses model, right? You make democratic countries tie their own hands such that no matter what governments do, they reach a certain limit. By now, probably something is in the minds of half the room, which is the Schuldenbremse. This is a precise example of one solution that neoliberals have proposed to the problem of democracy, is you set limits in advance for what democratic governments can do, how they can spend, and then they hit a wall that's just like the law says no, the institution says no, you cannot go farther than this. That is, that was the story of the globalist book I wrote. It was like what I called encasement of markets rather than liberation of markets, as it was often called, because I think what you got in globalization in the last few decades is not a kind of real opening up and flowering of possibilities for exchange. Actually, exchange was aimed in very specific ways and often through closely controlled conditions. Intellectual property is another good example, right, where ideas are much less free now than they were 40 or 50 years ago because of intellectual property law. So that's one solution, and Hong Kong gave an example of that. They included in their constitution that was created in the 1980s in consultation with the Chinese Communist Party, they put in a constitutional balanced budget amendment that is exactly like the Schuldenbremse, but 20 years before, saying that the government may not spend over a limit that it can match through its own revenue. They also put in constitutionally a low tax rate. So Hong Kong was most fascinating above all that they have a flat tax of 15% on individuals and on corporations. And that spread like wildfire through post-socialist countries in the 1990s as one country after another sort of competed with the next for mobile investors. So on the one hand, you could say the neoliberals have already an answer for democracy, which is just tie the hands of democratic governments and make sure that they can't really break the constraints of competitive capitalism. What is interesting, and the turning point really in my book, and the reason why I had to write this one after the last one, is that by the 1990s, the people who had been very enthusiastic about that idea, especially through things like the European Monetary Union, you know, the Growth and Stability, or the Stability Pact, it seemed like you had a great set of rules to prevent governments from straying too far from the path. But in their minds, the end of communism meant the rise of a many-headed beast of new threats. So before, you just had to worry about communism. By the 90s, in their mind, you had to worry about environmentalism, feminism, identity politics, people making demands in terms of, you know, marginalized or oppressed minority status, indigenous status, sexual minorities, and so on. So there was a fear that those elaborate structures that have been built to protect capitalism were now going to become something that were actually going to spread socialism. So hence, by the 90s, you got this interest in like exit, not just binding the democracy, but exiting the democracy. So how can you start building spaces that are no longer subject to potential oversight and interference by like a new politically, you would say, woke kind of feared majority? So that's where the zones come in, is you create little places where those woke majorities can't touch. That's what Canary Wharf was built on. London was governed by a very left-wing Greater London Council, as I describe in the book, in the 1980s. Thatcher took a space of the Isle of Dogs, an old industrial land, and said, this is not under the jurisdiction of the local labor government anymore. It's its own thing. It's an arrangement, backdoor between developers and Thatcher's own government now. And then she abolished the Greater London Council. So this is sort of like the alternative strategy that I'm showing, which helps explain why you could have ordo-liberal economists one decade supporting European Monetary Union, supporting the strength of the European Central Bank. And then the next decade, they're calling for the return of the Deutschmark, or calling for the creation of, the exit from the European Union. So one has to, I think, look over time to see why there are sort of strategies for like scaling up or opting out. Mm-hmm. That's helpful.
This authoritarian libertarians, mm-hmm. when we put them in that way, they more and more look like or are connected or are in an alliance with full fascists. Mm-hmm. So, but one would think that it is not so easy for them to come together, because for sure, whatever we might criticize on them, these libertarians have this pathos of freedom, but mm-hmm. also this this idea and this these values of individualism, mm-hmm. Which don't match too easy with the values of fascism. Mm-hmm. But they are now growing together, obviously. Mm-hmm. We had at Sunday the astonishing election results in Argentina, where a madman called Javier Milei had just won. He wants to destroy all the institutions. He defines himself as an anarcho-capitalist, mm-hmm. most radicalized form, let's put it in that way, of these authoritarian libertarians. But on the other hand, he is not really distinguishable anymore from people like Orban or Trump and something like that. How dangerous is this guy? For reasons of actuality, we can talk a little bit about the guy in Argentina.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I would say, kind of before answering that directly, I think that whether or not we're seeing sort of alliances with libertarians and fascists, I think, is actually kind of a hard question to answer. Because I don't think that it's true if you think about fascism in terms of 1930s style fascism, which was, had a great deal of confidence in the state and a great deal of belief in the organized, mobilized masses, understood as some kind of a pure ethnos or race that was going to dispel aliens from its midst. The fascists, the elements of the right that I think have created those alliances with libertarians, I think have been often better thought of, certainly in terms of their cultural chauvinism, but they're often interested in sort of subsidiarity going down very far. They're sort of decentralizers rather than fetishizers of the state. I think if you look at the IFD coalition, for example, it brings together ordo-liberals, libertarians, and then people who are interested in things like self-sufficiency and organic farming. Even the right wing of the IFD does not look like it really wants to conscript the entire population into a large scale 1930s style like industrial policy. So without that side of fascism as a version of like what the New Deal was, right, a kind of mass employment policy, a mass exercise of like the productive energies of the economy, then I wouldn't consider it fascism. I mean, it's despicable right-wing politics, but it doesn't have much to do with fascism anymore. And the narrative that I describe in the book, the term they use for themselves is paleo-libertarians. And the reason they call themselves that is that they think something that I think is probably true, which is if you want to do away with the government, there needs to be some other kind of glue that's going to hold society together. One thing, it's going to be just something like literal social contract where you'll sign a piece of paper and say, like, I agree to pay for this police force and my tax money will go to that. This is an exchange of fees for services. But they also, since the 1970s and 60s, have also thought that race is a good way to stick people together in the absence of a state. So in the 1990s, white racists were creating alliances with libertarians who wanted to get rid of the state, and they could agree that they wanted the same thing, which is not a big fascist-style 1930s state, they wanted very many small communities created voluntarily by contract. This one can be all white, that one can be all black, this one can be socialist, that one can be conservative. There'll be a checkerboard and a marketplace of polities, and that's the vision that they saw themselves as working towards. And they were happy to work with authoritarians because they wanted an authoritarian who would just smash up the existing institutions so they could get down to their new world of decentralized mini city-states and mini polities. So the libertarians of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, for example, they liked Trump and they've supported Trump, not because of any of his policies, just because they saw him as a chaos agent who could, you know, discredit government, begin the deconstruction of administrative state through his own incompetence, thus creating a more fertile ground as a transition to the world that they were hoping to get to, which is one where the legacy United States no longer exists. You don't have taxation, you don't have anything offered federally, everything is done at a small level. I think that, so Javier Milei, I think, can be looked at from two perspectives. One, he, like Bolsonaro, he's praised by some radical libertarians as a chaos agent who will, you know, break up existing coalitions and existing institutions to the point that thing will have to start from afresh. But two, he's a pretty mainstream guy when you actually look at his biography. I mean, I was watching a video of him on stage at the World Economic Forum in Panama City in 2014 when he was running the chief economist for an Argentine company that runs these kind of airport management and ownership logistics services. He advertises himself as an economist. He got the support of the very mainstream Mauricio Macri and Bullrich, who threw their support behind him after the first round. He doesn't quite want to destroy the government. He wants to combine, for example, the ministries of health, labor, and education into the Ministry of Human Capital. He wants to dollarize by getting rid of the central bank and connecting the Argentine peso to the Federal Reserve. But that's something that actually Latin American countries were playing with already in the 1990s, and it's not actually very anarchist, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you connect your currency to Washington, D.C. That seems something that's more like voluntary self-colonization than, you know, the new frontier of liberation. So I think that's sort of why he's effective as a politician, because people who are more practically minded can see in him as someone who's just going to break up sort of sclerotic, Peronist legacy coalitions. And then people who are young, who have been living in the wreckage of a pretty destroyed economy for decades, have no faith in the state anyway. And so when someone comes along and speaks to them in the language of social Darwinism and dog-eat-dog, zero-sum conflict, and says, the state's a bunch of crooks and politicians, you shouldn't trust them. They're like, yeah, that's my life. That was my dad's life. It's my grandfather's life. Why would you have faith in a kind of benevolent state at that point when your country has been choked again and again and again by the instruments of global capitalism, in fact? So I think that, you know, I think that you need to look at it that way, is that there's often this sort of tactical alliance between, you know, the term is like riding the tiger, like a lot of libertarians are willing to ride the tiger of a powerful authoritarian leader, not because they want to get to his or her version of the future, but because they just see them as a way to, you know, create the chaos that might be able to build something in its path.
Mm-hmm. What we also realize is that usually with people with other political voice point of views as we have, we understand the intuitive reasonable ideas they have. But what is so astonishing for me is that these libertarians and this kind of ideological forces you are describing in your books are often so counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Most people, it's not a question of being left and right. Most people would assume that if you destabilize a country, then you have turmoil, then you have the problems, as the Aufruhr, and it's not good to have it.
Right.
You don't want it. Yeah? Yeah. But the libertarians, they would say, great. Great, there is destruction, and if there is destruction, that's the best thing we want, The second would also be because you said, for sure it would be, we would understand it as reasonable when Peter Thiel now is saying, okay, I don't have to destroy the United States, I can capture it, doing my business with Trump or somebody else, and so that's good for me and my political program. But maybe we are wrong with that. Maybe they want to disunite the United States. Isn't that possible?
I mean, in some cases, yes. So, I mean, I don't want to lump libertarianism I don't want to paint it with too broad a brush. I mean, it's a very large tent, and there are certainly most people who would describe themselves as libertarians don't want anarchy in the United States, for example. They're happy with the way capitalism works for the most part. But I find this small radical minority very interesting. And I think that it would help people even in this room to understand where they're coming from better. If you think about it in terms of the way that communists and socialists were arguing 100 years ago or 110 years ago. So in the 1910s, in the 1920s, rightfully so, communists and socialists would say, world capitalism has entered a crisis. It's probably a terminal crisis. The whole thing is going to collapse, and we need now to build the new world in the ruins of this world that's falling apart, whether it was because of the First World War.
And it's better to make the collapse tomorrow than wait for 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. And also because you lose the moment of intervention, and your enemies grab that moment, the moment of opening. So you need to be a vanguard. You need to actually, through your own action, spark the inspiration of other people to enter through the gap, and all of these kind of military metaphors. So a lot of people in the world have experienced the last 20 years that way, the same way that people experienced in Europe the 1910s and 20s, which is a total collapse of their livelihoods, the eruption of often armed violence, a sense of being abandoned and actually, oppressed by the world's larger powers. So since 2008, there's a good chunk of the world, and I think this is why it comes as a shock to us when young Brazilians or young Argentines support these seemingly irrational candidates. But they just have been living in such situations of economic precarity and chaos that any option seems like a good option. And if someone comes and says, I have a plan, follow me, and it might be ugly in the short term, but we're going to build something better out of this that will be stable, then you go along with them. The difference is that instead of saying we're going to build something for the working class, or we're going to build something for a socialist Germany, or even build something for an international socialist world community or something like that, they're just saying we're going to build something for us. So you're either in this team, you get in now, the same way if you better buy Bitcoin now or else you're never going to be able to afford it. But if you buy it now, you're going to be rich in a year. You're creating these small sort of affinity groups of people who then see their own success and prosperity as at the expense of everyone else and defined by a sharp sense of being in an in-group that doesn't line up with any traditional forms of political affiliation. So it's not about class, it's not about nation, it's not even about city. It's about these sort of insurgent formations. And so I think if you think about their embrace of seemingly counterintuitive things that way, then it makes sense why they would say, as this one whole chapter in my book, Dutch libertarian in Somalia when the state collapses in Somalia, and he's like, finally, this is the chance now. We can build something truly from the ground up. People embracing the idea of going back to the Middle Ages because they think that, having many small city-states to choose from is much better than being captured in one empire. These are the kind of perspectives that I think it helps. It also just helps to jostle our own expectations of of the range of politics. Like for me anyway, when I find someone's politics that truly makes no sense to me, then it's very helpful to understand that because it helps me ask questions about my own assumptions too.
Because you mentioned these examples, I really was astonished by them too, because everybody would have seen Somalia as a humanitarian disaster, but there is a small couple of political radicals or ideologues or fantasts, and they think, oh, it's a wonderful opportunity. Nobody else would have seen that.
But there, I mean, if way. I can just dwell on that one for a minute, because like I actually like paradox and irony and surprise in history. I think history is filled with surprises. And I think that's a perfect example, the Somalia case. Because the joke that people often make about libertarians in the United States anyway is like, why don't you go live in Somalia? Yeah. And so this seems like, haha, it's a realization of that. He thinks Somalia is great. What a fool. But a couple of things to say about that. Dutch guy goes there. Sure, he creates a pretty strange crackpot book called The Law of the Somalis, which proposes creating a white businessman's clan on the model of Somali clan law. That much seems quite ridiculous. But then two things that aren't so ridiculous are, one is the place where he was planning to do that, he didn't succeed, but DP World did. Mm-hmm. So DP World has just built something very similar to what he was proposing that got its start actually during the Civil War. Why? Because as World Bank economists are constantly astonished to discover, Somalia's economy did better without a state than it did with a state. So the 1990s were actually an increase in quality of life, an increase in GDP, an increase in exports. The currency, the Somali shilling, circulated into neighboring countries. It was trusted as a unit of exchange with no central bank. Mm-hmm. So there's very interesting books about, like, called Economy Without a State. So on the one hand, yes, he's a crackpot, but on the other hand, you know, is he, or is there a kind of an insight into the world that we've actually created for ourselves such that seemingly crazy things can actually approximate reality? So I think the way that it exposes like how deeply certain kinds of commodifying forms of social life and market logics have sort of seeped in, you know, they're diagnostic in that way. Like they're strange things upon, you know, second examination can end up just being realities made strange for a moment.
So they are mad, but maybe it's the idea that we can stabilize a destabilized world, the more mad idea than their answer to destroy it.
I mean, in a way, I think that, you know, as opposed to the, you know, people on the left and social democratic people believing that we just need to get reasonable people in a room to agree about reasonable things. I mean, that doesn't seem to be any less psychotic at the moment than the kind of things that they're talking about, right? I mean, I just reviewed a book by Gordon Brown and Mohammed Al-Aryan, and this was their proposal. Like, well, why don't we just solve things? Well, that's a good question. Why don't we? You know?
but why don't we? I had also a talk here, I think, one month ago, or maybe about two, with Martin Wolf about his Cassandra-like book about that we should do everything to stabilize democratic capitalism. On the other hand, it's not wrong. I mean, why shouldn't we? Because the alternative is are the turmoils they are in front of us.
I think we should, but you know, some people have a bit of blood on their hands, and maybe blood is too strong a word, but I mean, Martin Wolf was part of the move in the 1980s and 90s to lock in all kinds of laws such that democracy had less power than it had previously. Now he's upset with what he's done, right? I mean, but he's not honest enough to admit that he was part of that. Instead, he points to Trump, he points to degrowth of all things, right? These are supposedly the things that have come in and destroyed global capitalism. I don't think so. It's the people in the center of power who have produced an unsustainable system that have now made these more radical alternatives attractive to some people. So I for some reason, like, it's that moderate, liberal, reasonable position that is almost the most infuriating for me these days.
But we can also say he's not coherent.
He's not what?
He's not coherent.
Coherent, yeah.
Yeah, coherent. Yeah. But we can also see that this radical liberals or radical libertarians, they are not really coherent. Because For sure, they did everything to destroy the normality of the 18th, 19th capitalism, deregulize, to put all the holes you're describing here, and if they put all the holes in the planet, and there's turmoil, they say let's bring back control. The same people, yeah, the same people. At first, they make their right wing propaganda with the regulation against welfare state and this, and everything else, and pro globalization. And in the end, the same persons are doing populist politics with the slogan "Take back control." It's right. Absolutely incoherent too.
Oh, of course. No, absolutely. No, I mean. This is not to defend the characters of my book. I think that, you know, but our solutions are elsewhere. It comes back to the unsatisfying binary of like dominium or imperium, world or nation. I think too often that's the end of the argument, is some people make arguments in terms of nation, and then people like Wolf say, no, we need to bring back sort of global responsibility. And then the nation people say, look what you did to us. We need to go back to the safety of the nation. And it's just like this ping pong of political, you know, conversation that just goes back and forth. I think that if you shift scale, and if you look at small scale experiments, whether they're at the community level, even neighborhood, city, you find a lot of nefarious negative things, but I think you also find a lot of really interesting responses to these challenges. So I think that, you know, part of my attention to the zone is not to discredit small-scale politics, but to actually make us attentive to the political possibilities of small-scale politics for people on the left as well. And I think that those, we can actually see something positive in the idea of experimentation and kind of emulation and working underneath the tissue of the federal government. Speaking as someone who lives in the United States, one of the problems that the left has had in the last 5 or 6 years has been too focused on national politics, right? It's all about the president, all about getting someone in the White House. And in the meantime, the right has taken over local government, has taken over state government, because they understand a little bit more about how you build hegemony and counter hegemony. So I think that, you know, if there's a call here, it's also a call to like looking in the cracks that have been created to figure out places we can, you know, work back, push back.
So the answer would be, one answer for the left, because you mentioned this, would be to concentrate more on the local level, to concentrate more on the communities, to care more about foundation of Genossenschaften than caring about macroeconomics?
I think in some cases, yeah. I think that these there have been pushes, for example, to create kind of like green zones. Mm-hmm. So the Scottish National Party wants to create green free ports. Mm-hmm. The Welsh government is also pushing like higher labor regulations inside of these free ports rather than low. The community land trusts in the UK have been working on decommodifying local privately held land and lumping it together into communal plots. And those are things that are hard to do at the national level overnight, but I think it's more possible to roll those out. Privatization was rolled out piecemeal, bit by bit by bit, and the pushback is probably also going to happen bit by bit by bit.
What I also found very astonishing in a book you mentioned it already, is that falling in love with the idea of the Middle Ages, of this neoconservative paleo-libertarians, which is also very counterintuitive what we usually think. Because the idea is all these centralizations after the Middle Ages culminating in a way in the central state, but also maybe culminating in a supranational order. This was the wrong way, and we should turn back the last 500 years, because the Middle Ages, they were wonderful, because there you had this Stadtstaaten and this different cities and mm-hmm. all these small principalities. Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of thing we should realize again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, part of it, I think, is as a historian, of course, I'm interested in the way that people and political movements find kind of usable pasts, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. they use stories from the past that usually are quite dubious, if not outright fictional, but they do something for them. So it's helpful for them to think about this version of the Middle Ages. The interesting thing for them, though, is I don't think it's usually quite that they think the Middle Ages was wonderful, more that they just think it was less bad, mm-hmm. right? So there is a fear of centralization as turning into tyranny or despotism over time, such that the advantage of the Middle Ages is it was easier to get out, as they say. But also the way that things like law and order were conducted more as commercial transactions. So, you know, if I killed your uncle, then rather than going to jail, maybe I just have to give you like a certain number of cattle or whatever. And this is seen as superior because it's not then taxing you to send the person who killed your uncle to jail. Like then you're losing twice, right? This is the argument, the libertarian argument for criminal justice reform, is we actually need to go back to more like eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Don't put people in jail, just make them, you know, if I kill your uncle, maybe I become your slave for 6 months, mm-hmm. right? They'll actually have these sort of proposals. Mm-hmm. So it's about disintermediating in such a way that the bloat of these parasitic states will be like reversed. And, you know, I obviously don't embrace that, but they produce surprisingly elaborate versions of Middle Ages. I first came across it because I was interested in this someone's book about privatizing prisons and privatizing police forces in the 1990s in the United States. And I picked it up expecting to read a bunch of economic arguments about saving money, police unions are expensive and disruptive. It was just a narrative of British medieval history from about the year 1000 into the year 1600. Like, wow, this is like half this book. And interestingly enough, he said that it was being brought over from Central Europe. So it was actually barbarian virtues of self-government, decision-making. You don't have an army, you just bring together a group of men from the village and go fight your battles. That was brought over to England and was later swamped by the French. So it's actually a deep, and this goes for Hayek and a lot of the British conservatives too, it's pro-Teutonic, anti-Norman, the idea that the French were the connection to Rome and they want to come in and rationalize everything and roll out states, whereas the Germans had the spirit of like individualism and decentralization. So it is weird for people in the United States to be talking about the Middle Ages, you know, when the Middle Ages in the United States was indigenous America that no longer exists. But it's symptomatic of their selective understanding of history.
And these state states and these different principalities and these little entities, mm-hmm. They have the advantage of this decentralization, for sure, mm-hmm. from the mm-hmm. point of view of these libertarians, the advantage of decentralization, that it's also not has this possibility of totalitarianism
right.
on the one hand, but on the other hand, it also leads to thousands of different entities that are in a way in a competition against each other, and mm-hmm. the one with the better solution will make better than the one with the mm-hmm. Worse solutions. And it's also very democratic in a way, because if I don't like this kind of entity, I move to the other entity which fits more. So this is the idea. But in reality, we have that. And now I come back to you, to the beginning and the presentation you gave. In a situation where we have not only national states or states also multinational states. I think we have today just around 200 states in the world. But as you put it, as you said, we have already 5,000 different zones with different legal systems. Mm-hmm. The Sonderwirtschaftszonen at that time, and the free ports, but also the tax havens. Mm-hmm. You didn't talk a lot about the tax havens also mm-hmm. in the book, but they are also a part of this yeah. system. So. In a way, we are already back in the yeah. medieval order.
Yeah. Yeah, so definitely. No, I think I can say a couple of things about that. One is that the impression of choice is often just that. It's an impression. So the gated communities are a great example mm-hmm. that in the 1990s, people were often in the mainstream press really worried about gated communities because they're saying it's like a new Middle Ages. People are moving to the countryside, creating these walls, barricading themselves off from society. The libertarians in my book were like, yes, exactly, and that's amazing. Like, let's do more of them. And we're using gated communities as examples of like a piecemeal fragmentation of the social landscape. The place where their depiction was off is the idea that you could search around and choose your own kind of space, you know, from a long menu of options. In fact, almost all the gated communities use the exact same contracts and the exact same set of laws. Why? Because there's insurance companies that want to make sure you're doing the exact same set of things. So it's not like a whole mosaic of beautiful experimentation. It's actually just many of the exact same cookie cutter thing repeated, you know, endlessly across the landscape. So that kind of liberty is actually not producing more choice. It's actually just producing more monotony and conformity, in fact.
Standardization,
right, exactly. But the second thing I would say, and this gets to your larger point, is that one of the reasons at the macro level why I've been really taken by the philosophy that they're proposing is I think they're also sort of, as the Americans say, saying the quiet part loud. And the quiet part they're saying loud is that mid-century dream, so when I showed that world of the 1950s and 1960s, new nations coming into the world system, there was still a quite well-grounded assumption at that time that if you were a new nation, you're Nigeria or you're India, you eventually will converge with your standard of living with a place like the United States. One of my favorite examples of this is an American congressman saying, we are going to lift Shanghai up and up until it is just like Kansas City. Of course, now Shanghai is much better than Kansas City. But you know, the idea of national liberation, meaning modernization in the sense that all of the world's peoples were on the same timeline that was eventually going to unite sometime, maybe not so distant future, 50 years, 60 years. Who believes that now? Right? No one. Like, in that sense, we've, I think, collectively, quietly lost that fantasy of modernization, but we haven't quite confessed that we've lost that fantasy yet to ourselves. They're happy to confess it. They're singing it from the rooftops. Right? They're like, that is dead. No way that everyone in the world is going to live the same way. No. The whole project is picking out the survivors. We're going to figure out who gets in the lifeboat. How much money do you have? Can you get in? What skills do you have to bring? And everyone else is going to die. We'll leave them all behind. They're not useful. They're disposable populations. They can be used perhaps for like some kind of a grunt labor, but that's the other way. It's like back to the Middle Ages. There's no one timeline that humanity is on, and as you say, we're already on that timeline. There is no more like promise of growth or promise of modernity, especially if you're sub-Saharan Africa. You've been left out. You've been left abject and sort of cast out of the march of modernity. And the zones are one of the technologies by which that's been made a reality. But I think they're also a way that we can see it becoming reality. Right? They're like an optic. They're a map of permanent inequality in a way, allowing us to see that in ways that can be otherwise elusive.
Thank you, Gwyn, for this part till now. We stop now the dialogue, the question and answer on the floor. I used the opportunity to say thank you for watching us on the on YouTube or the other channels on the digital sphere.